Israeli forces attacked Palestinian protesters in Beit El and Bethlehem amid widespread demonstrations across the West Bank against the Israeli onslaught on Gaza. More than 52,000 Palestinians are displaced by Israeli airstrikes that have destroyed or badly damaged some 450 buildings in the Gaza Strip. Two Israelis are killed after Palestinian rockets target Eshkol in southern Israel. Greetings and a warm welcome to World News. Good to have you with us. Now, our top story for this hour, Israeli forces have attacked Palestinian protesters who gathered in the occupied West Bank cities of Bethlehem and Beit El to condemn the regime's deadly aggression against the Gaza Strip. The regime forces fired tear gas to disperse the ralliers who in turn hurled rocks and burned tires to express their anger. A number of Palestinians were wounded. Thousands of people also took to the streets in Ramallah and Hebron, also known as Al-Khalil, in solidarity with Gaza. Clashes also erupted in Jerusalem Al-Quds, as well as Al-Aqsa Mosque, with Israelis arresting a number of Palestinians there. Meanwhile, a general strike is ongoing across the West Bank and East Jerusalem Al-Quds against the atrocities in the occupied territories in Gaza. On Monday, Israeli forces shot and killed two Palestinians during similar protests in the West Bank. Israel keeps bombing the Gaza Strip using warplanes, navy, and artillery units as the deadly onslaught on the besieged Palestinian land enters its second week. Now, in the latest attack, several residential buildings near Gaza's main hospital and other civilian areas were targeted. Israeli media say 65 locations in Gaza City and Khan Yunus were hit in half an hour. The regime's artillery also shelled the city of Rafah in southern Gaza. At least 212 people in Gaza, nearly half of them women and children, have lost their lives since Israel launched the attacks last Monday. The UN agency says that more than 52,000 Palestinians have been displaced. The agency has urged Tel Aviv to open border crossings for humanitarian supplies into Gaza. In the meantime, Palestinian resistance groups have launched fresh attacks on Israel in retaliation for the deadly onslaught on the Gaza Strip. Israeli officials said that two people were killed in rocket attacks on the Eshkol region in southern Israel, and that raised the death toll to 12 in Israel since the beginning of the attacks. Hamas's military wing said earlier that it had targeted an Israeli military post east of Gaza with mortar shells. The Ezzedine al-Qassam brigades also fired missiles into the Israeli cities of Okhtin and Netivot. Before that, the group fired rockets into Sderot and hit a gathering of Israeli soldiers near the city. Other Israeli cities, including Ashkelon and Be'er Sheva, as well as several military bases, were also targeted. In the past days, Palestinian rocket attacks also hit Tel Aviv. Resistance groups have promised some more such attacks if Israel does not stop the air strikes on Gaza. The United States has provided its ally Israel with new precision missiles so that the regime can continue with the onslaught against Palestinian women and children. In our news review program, my colleague has discussed with our guest the U.S. role in the Israeli war campaign against the Palestinians.
The Biden administration has approved the sale of $735 million worth of precision-guided weapons to Israel amid a rift in the U.S. Congress over the condemnation of the regime. Congress was officially notified of the proposed sale on May the 5th, a week before Israel launched its devastating offensive on the Gaza Strip. Lawmakers have 20 days to object to the sales with a non-binding resolution. A Democratic lawmaker on the House Foreign Affairs Committee objected to the move. The lawmaker said moving forward with the sales without pressuring Israel to agree to a ceasefire will only enable more carnage. Joining us for this edition of the News Review is Rabab Abdul Hadi, a founding director and senior scholar at the Arab and Muslim ethnicities and diasporas studies at San Francisco State University from San Francisco. And we also have Gina Rabai, a human rights activist from Beirut. Welcome. Ms. Abdul Hadi, if I could start with you. Biden hasn't backed down from this proposed sale of worth $735 million. What do you make of the timing?
I think it's very troubling. I think it's very problematic that the U.S. government is actually giving more weapons to Israel. Israel has been carrying out a massacre in Gaza against Palestinians with over 200 people killed, many women and children, but we should not also minimize the lives of men and youth who have been killed. And this is really troubling to actually say that Israel needs precision, high precision, in order to kill more Palestinians. Israel has been claiming that it has been precisely pinpointing, and it's contributing to more carnage and more killing of Palestinians. So I'm definitely against it. I condemn it, and I believe that what should happen now is immediate seizure and stop of all U.S. aid to Israel. Every single Israel is actually violating U.S. Law itself, isn't it? Not only violating international law, it's violating U.S. law that governs the sale of weapons to any foreign country.
Mr. Rabai, what's your opinion on this? As our guest just alluded to, these are precision-guided missiles to add to Israel's stockpile. I have never seen or never heard of precision-guided missiles that killed 61 children in a week and 40 women in a week, or destroy a media center, for example.
Good evening to you and to all the audience. Well, regarding any U.S. actions, we cannot rely on U.S. actions, whatever they are, regarding the Palestinian issue, because the U.S. is the main ally and supporter of Israel. And without the U.S., Israel wouldn't exist anymore, because it is the ally that actually supports the existence of Israel. I want to start with the Sheikh Jarrah issue, because it is the incident that started this whole clash again. The Sheikh Jarrah issue is actually a miniature, so to speak, of the entire Palestinian issue. The Palestinian issue is the case of the biggest theft and impunity in human history, which took place before the eyes of the whole world, and most of the world remains silent about it, in a world that has proven that it respects only the strongest and the powerful, and obeys the strongest and legitimates the actions of the strongest, and the most powerful, even if unjust. It is also ready to witness the theft of an entire country, as happened to Palestine, and then make the thief a member of the United Nations, because the most powerful, namely the United States and Britain in this case, imposed that. Everyone who lives in this time, in this era, bears witness to this fact, even if they deny it. From this standpoint, we came to know with certainty, that what is taken by force can only be restored by force. The most prominent manifestation of this balance of force versus force during this period, specifically the armed clashes between the resistance in Gaza and the Israeli entity, is actually the international discourse nowadays regarding the Palestinian issue. Some international bodies started talking about the two-state solution and East Jerusalem as part of the Palestinian state. Why take this stand now? Simply because the Palestinians adjusted the balance of power and created equations of power that revived the Palestinian issue and reaffirmed that the world only respects the powerful.
Thank you very much indeed. Let's thank our guest, Rabab Abdul Hadi, political commentator, joining us out of San Francisco, and Gina Rabai, human rights activist, joining us out of Beirut. That brings an end to this edition of the News Review. Thank you for staying tuned.
Now, moving on with the rest of this broadcast, a cyclonic storm has pummeled northwestern India, leaving more than 24 people dead and scores more missing. It made landfall Monday evening and battered five states stretching from Kerala in the far southern part of the country to Gujarat in the northwest. It left a trail of damage with winds knocking over trees and power lines. Some areas were underwater due to the excessive rainfall. Hundreds of thousands of people are without power. Authorities in the commercial hub of Mumbai have closed the city airport and urge people to stay indoors. Meantime, search operation is underway for 96 people missing after a vessel adrift Mumbai's coast and sank during the cyclone. Total COVID cases in India have surged past the 25 million mark, making the country the second in the world after the U.S. to pass that grim milestone. On Tuesday, the country recorded well over 263,000 new cases in a day, and that pushes the tally to more than 25.2 million. There were also a record 4,329 new deaths. They bring India's fatalities to 279,000. The country has the third largest COVID deaths in the world. Recently, the World Health Organization warned that the second year of the pandemic could be even worse than the first. And that announcement came after Prime Minister Modi sounded the alarm over the rapid spread of the disease across India. Munawwar Zaman says the second COVID wave is yet to peak in India, in spite of the measures taken to curb the spread of the virus.
But the situation has somehow been under control over the last 3 or 4 days. What we say under control doesn't mean that COVID has started retreating. But yes, the number of active cases is dropping to a marginal level. But at the same time, the death toll is climbing. What we are talking about, these are those people who were already admitted in the hospitals in the different places. And that's the reason why we are seeing a phenomenal rise in the death toll. And this death toll is expected to rise further in the coming weeks. What we see in the change in trends, for example, the drop in cases is because of the fact that the countries, many states of the countries, have announced their own measures, such as lockdowns and restrictions, that has helped the country to contain the spread to some extent. But let me tell you that this is not the peak. We are yet to wait. We are still waiting for second wave peak, which scientists believe is the month of August.
Now, Iran has reported more coronavirus infections and related deaths across the nation in the past day. According to health authorities, 310 more people have succumbed to the disease, and that pushes the death toll to more than 77,500. Iran has been reporting less than 400 daily deaths in the past few days. Authorities logged 14,000 new daily infections. That raises the caseload to 2.7 million. The government imposed restrictions last month following a steep rise in deaths and infections. Health experts blamed the UK version of the virus and also the people's failure to follow the health protocols for the rise in infection cases. Turkey has eased the virus restrictions from Monday as new cases of COVID decline following a 3-week lockdown in that country. Rashan Saklan has a report.
Turkey started a normalization phase after 3 weeks of lockdown. A 15-day long period of eased but not lifted restrictions has started in the country as daily numbers of new infected started falling. Due to the measures taken during the holy month of Ramadan, the numbers decreased from 60,000 per day to something near 10,000. Turkish president said the country hoped to overcome this pandemic as the new waves across the world has badly affected the situation in Turkey. He also stressed the importance of taking the vaccine to overcome this phase so that Turkey could go back to normal life soon.
Normalleşme adımlarını atıyoruz.
We have started implementing our normalization calendar as of Monday. The restrictions will be eased in phases until the end of May and significantly as of June.
Experts say that the gradual normalization would not result in another increase in the numbers of daily infections. They also advise citizens to minimize their home visits to relatives and friends, as well as stay away from shopping malls and crowded areas.
The number of daily infection cases has reached a logical point, paving the way for easing the lockdown. We need to ease the lockdown to make a balance between containing the spread of the virus and allowing our people to go back to work and get prepared to welcome tourists. Our economy has been negatively affected with the lockdowns over the past year. We are trying to continue with the vaccination campaign. The government is now trying to get more vaccine jabs.
Most of the travel restrictions will be lifted, but nighttime and weekend curfews will remain in place, and restaurants will only open for food deliveries. With the new measures, Turkey hopes to compensate the economic losses it sustained over the past year. If tourists don't return to Turkish beaches this year, the nation's current account balance and lira are likely to be hit. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Families of the victims of the May 8th deadly blast near a school in western Kabul have demanded the incident be probed by the United Nations and other international bodies. Amin Alami has more from Kabul.
The families of the victims of the recent deadly attack near a school in Kabul call for proper attention to be paid to those affected by the incident. The families put the casualties at 90 deaths and over 240 wounded, all students. They also called on the international community, the UN and human rights bodies to probe the brutal attack. Referring to repeated targeting of Shia people by terrorist groups in Afghanistan, they also urged the international bodies to officially confirm the systematic genocide of Shia people in the country.
The attack on Sayyid al-Shuhada school came after a series of targeted attacks on Shia religious sites, educational centers, and sports clubs. It's a genocide, and we want the government and international bodies to officially confirm Shia genocide in Afghanistan.
But as observers say, it seems that neither terrorist attacks nor political obstacles can push back the determined young generation of Afghanistan, as they are fully committed to go forward in order to build their own country by relying on knowledge instead of war and violence.
The government has not yet fulfilled its obligation to protect us. The recent attack on innocent schoolgirls was a big tragedy, and such incidents must be stopped in the future. The enemy must know that we will go forward despite the challenges.
It was in the afternoon of May 8 when three back-to-back blasts rocked western Kabul, and many fasting residents of the area witnessed how dozens of schoolgirls were hit by these blasts. Although the Taliban has denied any involvement in the attack, but none of other terrorist groups, including Daesh, has claimed responsibility too.
Afghanistan's Independent Human Rights Commission has emphasized on the need for a practical step from the government. President Ghani has already ordered a thorough probe into the attack and has called on his government to work on a plan to boost the security in Kabul. Sayed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish. Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Gunrunners, directed by Canadian documentary filmmaker Anjali Nayar. And joining me in the studio, we have Lee Singer, who is a film journalist and video essayist, whose work has appeared in various major newspapers, magazines, and online outlets. And beside him is Tete Kofi, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Gunrunners, which is shot over a 10-year period, follows two Kenyan cattle rustlers, also known as warriors, Julius Arile and Robert Mutanda, who put their violent past behind them to become marathon runners as part of a government-sponsored program to disarm the conflict-heavy region. We see Arile enter international marathons, while Mutanda gets involved in the political sphere and dreams of working towards policy change. Though as we see these once notorious warriors given a chance to pursue their dreams, we realize that the road to glory is full of bumps and detours for these charismatic men. Well, first of all, welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, Kenya is known as a destination for world-class marathon runners, but it's not as glamorous as it seems to be a top athlete in that part of the world, particularly because some of them are quite literally running for their lives, running away from crime, and we see that cattle stealing, or cattle wrestling, as it's called, is quite commonplace because that's an important source of income, and this region is also engulfed in the illegal arms trade industry, which is part of a global multi-billion dollar industry. Lee, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, firstly, it's just a fascinating sort of insight into, you know, a situation that I really did not know much about. You know, I know very well that Kenya is a history of producing great runners. I didn't know about this, you know, pretty fantastic government-run program, this sort of amnesty and the disarmament idea, which is a really great one, and obviously it gives a great film title then, Gunrunners. The film itself, I mean, I think it was shot over 10 years, so you can only imagine how much footage has been accumulated during that time. And I guess, as fascinating as I found the subject and the two principal characters, I felt that in a sort of 90-minute running time, you're kind of skipping big chunks. You know, so much is going on, and I didn't feel that I was getting to know the two men in the way that I would have liked. I mean, basically, I could imagine a longer film it's longer, but you would have felt more in getting into the rhythm of what's going on with these people, because there's so much to say, and they go through so many changes, both of them individually, and I feel 90 minutes doesn't necessarily do justice to everything that's, you know, it's trying to encapsulate.
You're right, it is absolutely jam-packed. It touches on issues of violence, as well as the main themes of sports and running, but then also politics and corruption. There's just so much in this documentary. And Tete, if I could turn to you, what was your take on Gunrunners?
Okay, normally when I'm told about documentaries about Africa, I yawn, roll my eyes and go, oh God, not again. I tend to want to avoid them. I was very pleasantly surprised by this for two reasons. One, it was rich in context, so that whatever was going through the lives of these two, the protagonists, if you like, it was placed within context and it gave you an understanding of the environment from which they came. Secondly, I think it was done with quite a lot of sensitivity. There's little tricks he used in what you call chopping and changing. I mean, cutting from the Rift Valley, training scenes.
Which is absolutely
camps,
breathtaking.
Exquisite. In Kenya, over to the skyscrapers of New York. You could see that these are two little people operating in one world, but kind of moving out into a much, much bigger world. And the third thing I really liked about it was that it looks as if these two characters are archetypes. Arile is very much the superstar, the very talented runner and so on. And his mate, Mutanda, seems to be much more the political type. So how the two characters fare was something I was always watching to see. I was impressed.
I'd like to pick apart their characters a bit later on.
Sure.
But Lee, I'd like to ask you, this documentary kind of describes itself as the American dream, but Kenyan style. It's an interesting analogy. What are your thoughts on this?
Yeah, I'm always a bit puzzled by this American dream. I don't understand why, you know, one country has a monopoly on wanting to change your life for the better and improve your situation. I mean, it's a cute tagline. I think it's kind of irrelevant. The fact is, yes, they do go to New York and, you know, run marathons there. But, you know, marathon running is a world global pursuit. And I think, you know, to me, it smacks more of marketing than any sort of reality. Can it, you know, why can't it be a Kenyan dream?
This Saturday marks the first annual Tekla Lerupe Peace Race. Tekla Lerupe, the former marathon world record holder from the conflict region, is partnering with the government to invite cattle rustlers to trade in their weapons in exchange for amnesty and a chance to win cows and cash prizes.
We learn from this film that this amnesty program is quite inspirational. How does it transform the lives of Aurelia Mutanda, Lee?
Well, I mean, you know, until this program comes in, they are very aware that they're living a very precarious, you know, highly dangerous existence, and one that they're very clearly both uncomfortable with. You know, it does involve, they don't answer it directly, but you very much get the sense that they've been involved in deaths. And obviously they've had loved ones or friends die as well. So it's just a really unpleasant, you know, precarious existence. So this government program is really trying to give people a kind of a firmer foothold in, I guess, you know, quote unquote, the right direction. So taking them away from sort of illegal activities, illegal guns, and trying to sort of, you know, push their energies and their sort of, their, you know, their outlook in a more kind of positive and, you know, peaceful direction. So that's a great thing.
And Tete, the film sheds a positive light on this amnesty program. How effective is it really? And can you talk more a bit about this?
Well, there are a couple of things which come out. For a program to work, you've got to be able to transfer skills which are being adversely used or not constructively used into something which is positive. And in the way the story pans out with these two characters, Mutanda is very much the organizer. I mean, he had 500 effectively gangsters, hoodlums, they call themselves rustlers, under his charge. So this guy's a people organizer. And of course, he's the one whose skills are now deployed in the political arena, actually getting people involved with the program, even campaigning for a parliamentary candidate. And he says he himself has parliamentary aspirations. Then Aurelia, on the other hand, is the rising star, the hugely talented individual. They said that even as a kid, he was winning things at kind of at the local level. So his skills, his competitive drive is now being, you know, applied in an arena which can actually make him money, improve the quality of his personal life, the life of his family, and so on. And it does say that a lot depends on the quality of government, the environment you provide. These talents are available in bad neighborhoods, and they're available in the right postcodes. The difference is that in the right postcode or a stable environment, those talents are able to flourish because they are positively deployed. So in terms of this gun amnesty, Kenya had a problem. I think it was a blindingly inspired idea. It's one of the funniest quotes I actually picked up from this was he said, well, the skills I need to run, I need to be able to run fast to chase cattle, and I need to be run fast to escape the police. And he's doing that in a marathon.
That's exactly the point of this film, is that violence goes hand in hand
exactly.
with their ability
exactly.
to be good athletes.
Yeah.
And Lee, if I could ask you, an issue that is raised in this documentary is that when you have a gun, you have a sense of power. So it seems as if it's an accepted reality or part of life in Kenya.
There's an amazing quote, and to be honest, it's the thing that probably stayed with me most from this film. I think it's Mutanda he's talking. He's like, you know, if you haven't killed someone, if you haven't stolen their property, then what kind of a warrior are you? And to me, this is really then what they're actually really trying to do underlying is change the whole paradigm of what makes a warrior or actually a man. And actually, that's something that is a huge, that's not just particular to this country, it's something we probably all need to look at in, you know, different societies, the way we construct masculine identity. And it shouldn't be about trying to dominate and power and, you know, impose yourself. And I think actually they don't explore that anymore, sadly, I felt in this. Mm. But the fact that he vocalizes it shows that actually it's making him reconsider what, you know, as a warrior he should be doing. And then the fact that he goes into more sort of, you know, political and sort of socially constructive things is obviously helping that situation.
was in the bush. I used to run. That's why when I came here, I didn't find the difficult when I started to run. Because I was running even 100 kilometers. You know, when the police is chasing you, also you chase the cattle. So you chase very fast. But if you chase very slowly, the police will capture you. And then you'll be in a hot soup.
I found both characters to be quite endearing, but I think Matanda was the more charismatic one out of the two. And we get the sense that he had a much darker past than Arile. There was a moment when he was asked how many people he's killed, and he just looks off camera and remains silent, which is quite chilling to watch. Lee, what did you make of Matanda's character compared to Arile's?
Yeah, I mean, one of the strengths of the film is that they are very different, so you have that immediate contrast. And Tete's, described it very well. Matanda's the sort of more social, political animal. He has a natural ability and affinity to kind of, draw people in. Arile is much more kind of, quieter, more sort of focused on his own sort of goals. And so that, I think, is one of the main strengths of the film, because as you follow their paths, you find that actually they diverge more than you might expect, because actually they aren't equally talented runners. So then one storyline really pursues the actual running side of it, and the other goes, I would say, into equally or maybe more interesting avenues about, well, if you can't do that, it's not just, guns or running. Actually, if the running is not going to be your career, you can use your skills in different ways, and I think that's a very interesting.
And we see Matanda pursue politics, but then of course we learned that it seems to be a corrupt world, and it's almost he embraces it and talks about it openly. Tete, is this a reality of life in Kenya?
It's a reality of life in Kenya, and not just Kenya, a lot of African countries. It's also the reality of life over here, but it's because there's a lot more wealth, and because ordinary people's needs are taken care of on a day-to-day basis, you don't see it as starkly. But in Kenya, it's very clear. I mean, he threatens the politician that if you don't make me, minister in charge of security, which he patently won't be able to hold, he wouldn't be able to hold that position. He said he'd mobilize things against him. But what it says to me is that these individual talents are kind of drawn into this prism of organization, be it the sport, be it politics, be it whatever. And it is the quality of the organization that can absolutely, enable them or absolutely destroy them.
And I want to touch quickly on the point about guns. We find out in this documentary also that there's 500,000 illegal guns in Kenya. I mean, where are they coming from and why are they there?
Well, I mean, there was a breakup of the Soviet Union, and that led to a huge kind of splurge of small arms all over the world. And, of course, these things are what are required to create kind of little lordships in all of these different countries. And it is one of the saddest statistics of African life that where there are the greatest resources, you have the greatest conflict. So a country like the Congo, which is incredibly wealthy, has had internecine strife for near on 40 years consecutively. Of course, while that happens, the natives can't benefit from the resources in their land, but other agents do. And unfortunately, it is often foreign agents who enable these weapons to get into the hands of these people. And so that it's almost a system of divide and rule. But of course, if you're a politician in Africa and you're accepting bribes from foreign agents to create conflict and strife in your own country, that's a decision only you can make. Nobody holds a gun to your head to do that. So it comes to issues around personal integrity and so on and so forth.
That's a really interesting point, but I'm afraid we'll have to move on just for the time being.
Dream about my future. Mostly I dream about money. I will build this, I will build that. Many things like that.
My name is Julius Arile from Kenya. 6 years ago, being a warrior, fighting with another people from our country. But this time now, I am an athlete and I can run a marathon.
You really does need to make a breakthrough And if he doesn't have it, then it's going to be harder to fulfill this kind of dream of being in New York as an elite, top elite athlete that could maybe make it in the top five.
Good morning and welcome to Prague, Czech Republic, for the 19th running of the Volkswagen Prague Marathon.
A great race starting at Prague's Old Town Square in this historic city.
So really is very much the underdog character in this documentary, and you really find yourself rooting for him. He has a lot of pressure on himself to prove himself, and he dreams of being on the wall, as he says, of all the top runners of Kenya. And we see him come seventh place in the first race, but then do really well in the second opportunity he has. What did you make of this sort of triumphant arc he had?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I guess when you're choosing your characters to focus on at the beginning of a journey, you have no idea, actually, are they going to make it? So I think it's less, it sounds a cliche, but it's less about the destination than the journey. It's fascinating to follow this particular man on his sort of athletics career. Now, if he, you know, ends up winning a gold medal at the Olympics, even more extraordinary. But actually, I find it more interesting when you see the real struggles and the person who isn't necessarily going to be the ultimate victor in this. The film really made me think about an American documentary called Hoop Dreams from the 1990s, which followed two young inner-city kids who wanted to be basketball stars. Now, neither of them end up making it, but what you get is a fascinating portrait of their environment and the world that they're in and the politics and the social disadvantages. And actually, that's a more illuminating and, I think, more fascinating storyline than just, you know, the underdog who comes from nowhere to, you know, in the last minute, you know, storms to the front and wins the medal. That's interesting, but I'm more interested in the sort of the world that shapes their, you know.
Of course, he's plagued by poverty and injuries and not the same opportunities. Tete, I see you agreeing with Lee there?
Yeah, but absolutely, the journey's fascinating. And none of these characters are pristine. Got somebody pregnant when she was quite young. It led to her suicide and led to him becoming a warrior. But later on, he's now got three wives and children by all of them. So if he's not able to take that, put each one of his problems in some kind of compartment, he won't be able to pursue his dream. So these dreams are always fraught. And actually, the story, as you say very well, is the compromises, you know, the calls that each person has to make to pursue what it is that they're really after, and an illumination of the environment within which all of this is going on. Mm-hmm.
I want to talk now about the parallels we see between Kenya and the US, sort of the Western world. Lee, what did you make of their journey, of Relay's journey to New York, and sort of the observations and comments he was making?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's very much sort of fish out of water stuff, right? So, you know, where they've grown up, where they live, what they're used to is obviously a world away from, you know, the slightly, you know, more glamorous, the more professional, the more kind of money at stake world that they go into. But I think, again, what's really interesting is in their own world as well, you see the way that they're not quite fitting in and the problems that they have. And to be honest, I would have liked the film to touch more on that. Like Tete says, they have these very checkered family lives. That's not really grappled with in the way that I would have, you know, appreciated a bit more. And I feel that, you know, of course the thread is the running and the marathon and what happens, but actually to get to know them even a bit more as characters and get a sort of a more rounded portrait of them, I would have liked to hear more about those sort of difficulties with the families and the wives and the kids, because it obviously has an impact. He wants to earn money so he can go back and provide for them, but we don't necessarily get, you know, the full story about what that entails.
And Tete, isn't it quite sad, though, that this notion of success, we see Arile move to sort of a shack-like accommodation, and he thinks he's living in a European city. Why is that this connection of success is linked to Europe and the West?
Well, success is always relative to what you've got. I mean, this guy wasn't having three baths a week out in the bush, and he's suddenly in a shack with running water. I mean, that's luxury. He might as well, from his point of view, be at the Ritz Hotel. It's absolutely relative. But what I think it's important for people to also think about is the fact that this can be quite corrupting. This kind of drive to live in that star-spangled environment can be quite corrupting, because we all know that the industry that he's now becoming a part of, the elite athletic politics industry is also incredibly corrupt.
Which is mainly dominated, sort of, as we see, by Western physiotherapists and management types.
Sure. It's incredibly corrupt. So it's really a story about how, you know, man has to try and make it, making moral judgments at every turn of the way in a not-so-easy world.
I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there, gentlemen. Thank you very much for joining Doc Review. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/EN. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
The Gate of Knowledge. Exegesis and interpretations of the supremely eloquent sermons, letters, and sayings of the Commander of the Faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio with Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وعلى أهل بيته الطيبين الطاهرين Dear listeners to IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. I welcome you all to this episode of The Gate of Knowledge, where we are discussing about the qualities of the pious people based on the sermon number 184 in Nahj al-Balagha, the Khutbatul Muttaqin or the Khutbatul Hammam. And we reach this phrase where Imam Ali alayhi salam is talking about a very important quality of the pious people, and that is وَلَا يَخْرُجُ مِنَ الْحَقِّ, that the pious person never exits the truth. And the criterion for the truth is to base a person's actions based on a divine intention, and also the actions should be based on divine commandments. That is the criterion, the main criterion for truth. And of course, there are other different things that are deeper here that, of course, we don't have the knowledge to be able to discuss myself, and we need guidance from higher people about the reality of the truth. You know, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the Holy Quran mentions about the truth in a very advanced and intricate manner, where he talks about the fact that Allah makes sure that every entity is able to have an understanding of the truth.
You're listening to the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio, a program that presents a detailed commentary of Peak of Eloquence from the Master of the Faithful, Imam Ali, peace be upon him.
Now, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, when he talks about the truth, he talks about it in a very intricate manner, and he says that definitely we will show our signs to them in the horizons and in their own souls until they will know the truth. حَتَّى يَتَبَيَّنَ لَهُمْ أَنَّهُ الْحَقِّ. They will realize that God is the truth. That means these signs will come within yourself, inside your heart, in different situations. You will realize that Allah will show you that He is the only truth, and He is the basis of the whole of existence, and He is the true reality. But the way towards that is when a person follows the commandments of God. That is where God is there. If a person wants to see God, he wants to see the truth, the path towards seeing the truth is through the right actions and avoiding the wrong actions. That's where a person will be able to see the truth. Anyways, inshallah, that was the previous part. Today, inshallah, we'll discuss another section where Imam Ali alayhi salam says that in samat lam yaghummuhu samdu wa in dhahik lam ya'alu sawtu, that a pious person is one who, when he is silent, لَمْ يَغُمُّهُ صَمْتُ, that a pious person is such that when he is silent, his silence doesn't make him sad. Now the question here would be that why would a person be sad by remaining silent? Of course, this is when a person is probably referring to the fact that when a person makes an error or is silent in a place where he is not supposed to be silent. You see, when a person is silent when he is supposed to be speaking and doing something that is important, and speaking, let's say, for the truth and in support of the oppressed people, and he remains silent at that point, definitely that sadness, that type of silence will make him sad, because he knows that if I would have spoken the truth at that time, then I would have helped a poor person. I would have helped the oppressed people of the world or oppressed person in the society. But a pious person, because of his adherence to the commandments of God, is so firm in what he speaks and what he is silent about that such a situation doesn't occur.
Stay tuned to the IRIB English Radio.
Now, we say that a pious person is one whose silence doesn't make him sad, meaning that his silence also is based on certain defined principles. And he has control over how he speaks and how he controls himself and what he doesn't speak. It is such that this control that he has over himself, over what he speaks and what he doesn't speak, gives him that opportunity and gives him that special privilege to be in a state of happiness when he is silent. You will notice that many a times in our lives we'll have come across that if we look at our lives properly, we will see that we were silent in some areas whereby if we would have spoken a word, we would have changed a very big thing in the society, a very important thing in the society. These experiences everyone must have in their lives, whereby they would have helped one who is being slandered, they would have supported one who is being destroyed, whose respect is being destroyed. At times you hear your friend or a person backbiting another person, and we remain silent. This type of silence is a wrong form of silence. This form of silence is something that is destructive, something that is, you can say, that reduces progress, that is regressive. And a pious person has got, because of that control and that understanding that he has of the society, of the situation, of when to speak, when not to speak, he has this ability to be able to be silent at the right time. Let us pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that he gives us the opportunity to be able to adhere to this particular commandment and this particular quality that Imam Ali alayhi salam has mentioned regarding the people who are pious. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Sheikh Mukhtar, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome, on the program Gate of Knowledge on IRIB English Radio.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM, 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or BATR 5, and via Internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.